Ethan, what I am fixated on, I have to say, is that the report that the crowd was astonished at Jesus's teaching. I have to say, I have rarely, if ever, had anyone astonished at my preaching. So already this feels a bit unreal. And because he spoke with an authority, an unusual authority that the other religious leaders did not possess, they were hearing something different. Do you have any thoughts on that? What amazed them, and then what? Why Jesus spoke with an authority that was unusual?
So the amazement is on the part of the other authorities, on a part of, or on the part of the people hearing him preach.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's I'll venture it's the people who were hearing him, and Jesus' authority is being questioned by the other authorities.
I see.
What is that authority?
What
is it that they that astonished them?
Yeah.
Now, well, before we even hit the text, I want to know, because like I said, I saw that and I wanted to know from the beginning. What's astonishing?
And I think what we should do is connect it to the demon, because it's not just that the crowds were impressed. It's that this authority prompted this demon to cry out as well. So someone who's antithetically opposed to Jesus and his ministry is also crying out. So I think that plays into this as well. That this is the authority over, you know, the divine authority over heaven and earth, right? Over all the spiritual beings, over all creation. Not to say that, I mean, that sounds like the cliche answer.
No, I know, but it is the answer.
But it is the answer, yeah. It's not just, you know, a rhetorical ability or a persuasive authority. It's that there was something substantial in Jesus' own identity, in his existence, right? And like you mentioned last week, to me, it's astonishing because Jesus is Jesus, right? Jesus is the son of Joseph. And there's no way someone should have this kind of authority.
So we know that when you asked last time what keeps us going at preaching, it is that we are ourselves not astonishing, but that we speak with the authority of the word that astonishes. And I very much like that it is the authority of one who goes between heaven and earth, between the temporal and eternal, between mortality and immortality, right? No one can speak that way because no one is incarnate. So here we have again, Luke just, enjoying the truth of the incarnation as it's unfolding, and oftentimes it unfolds with disagreement as here, but if the spiritual is really more real than the physical, if the unseen is more real than the seen, then Jesus's words alerted people to that fact, that when he's speaking, it's possible to believe that the physical world is not the only world, and that his authority is greater than even the demonic authorities, which are bent on our destruction. That is, to answer last week's question, I guess that's one of the reasons why each week we try to have something to say about the gospel lesson, because it is preached with the authority of Christ. Now, here's my question. Jesus said, this is so important, I've got to preach. And then he goes and departs into a desolate place, a desert.
Yes.
It didn't seem that important.
That was my question, too, when I got to the end of this, that he had to go off into the desolate place to preach.
Yeah, these are, I think, the two things, that the good news is both that it has to be preached, but it's also that it's not up to us. Right? Mm-hmm. It's a good news of things happening and the good news of nothing happening. So what do you think of the image of us gathering on Sunday morning and that is the desolate place, even though it's the place we hear preaching? Right? It's where everything stops. It's the desert. And in that, we enter as people who are, there to receive, passive. mm-hmm. not to do stuff. I kind of like the image, although I hope that you disagree with it.
In my mind, our worship and our liturgy is too busy to accomplish that. Yeah. But then again, the wilderness isn't completely void. There is, you know, if you're in the wilderness and pay attention, you're going to see the little bits of life that manage to thrive in that desolate place.
Maybe there we have it.
There. Yeah.
That cliche of pay attention, it comes back, and it's more than a cliche, is that this is the place where we repeat the same words. They're scheduled and scripted, and yet the promise of that is that it focuses our, you know, it concentrates our minds on the things that matter. And the things that matter are this, that the incarnation means that what's true in heaven is becoming true on earth as we pray in the Lord's Prayer. And it's not true because we experienced it existentially. It's true because it happened in the incarnation, right? We can, whatever else we experience, we still have the words of the gospel saying, this already happened. Now, you may not agree with it, you may not follow it, but the fact is that the incarnation was the very thing that, the very truth that we wish we could maybe experience a little bit more ecstatically or experientially.
Do you think people actually want to experience the life of faith in that sort of ecstatic way? Or would that be, or would that overwhelm them and leave them doubting?
All right, that's a good question. When I get to, you know, the Gloria in Excelsis, and my mind immediately goes to, you know, Isaiah before the throne of God, I'd like a little more of that. You know, when you're just in the presence, and we say it over and over, three times in the service, we say, the Lord be with you and also with you. So in other words, we're desiring to be in God's presence. And Isaiah in God's presence was, he said, I'm undone, you know, I'm coming apart. When Peter was in Jesus' presence and he recognized him as God, you know, he tore off his clothes. Now, I don't want that to happen, but... You know, probably you're right. We wouldn't want that to happen too frequently. But the fact is that if we actually saw what the incarnation did, it would produce that in us. And yeah. And I think you're right that God gives us this, you know, his presence in doses so that we keep our clothes on and that we don't become undone in his presence. But our own liturgy reminds us that's what the presence of God is. So at any rate, I very much like that Jesus, first of all, it's a very simple text. He says that this good news will always in the end be heard as good news, which means that it always must be preached. And that kind of lifts the pressure. It needs to be preached whether I'm feeling it or not. Right? Mm, yeah. Whether I think I'm accomplishing anything or not, whether it just feels like a repetition that is boring or not, that is the case. So,
how do we link that preaching with the healing? Because it's you've got the preaching and teaching sort of as a bookend between that encapsulates the casting out of the demon and the healing of Peter's mother-in-law. You know, why, you know, how do we bring these things together?
I very much like the fact that those things that happen at the will of Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, we can say, so in other words, we're not left to fabricate that, try to generate it through showmanship or whatever. It is a gift. And when it's given, it is, you know, to be celebrated. You know, the real stories I hear from the church in Africa is that the actual authority of Jesus' words taking hold of people is palpable. It's right. You can see it, right? And the miraculous is not extraordinary. And of course, there's all sorts of deceptions and wanting to be more important. But the fact is that these miracles said, this is the horizon that we're desiring. Our horizons aren't just on this life, wanting Jesus to fix this or that problem. We want the whole shebang to be fixed. And the signs of that, that Jesus is capable, obviously are this, you know, the spiritual healing of the demoniac and the physical healings. So, yeah, the miracles are not unimportant. They're just not very frequent. So the psalm kind of focuses our attention in that the hope of the psalmist is that in this word there is a refuge. How it's a refuge, I can, you know, I think that people have to draw on their own biographies to know that when the word became this refuge for them, when it gave them, you know, I usually we just say it gives hope. In the hopeless times, it gives faith when people have lost faith, and it gives love. It's continually. So, I mean, we just take the Christian virtues, but it goes way beyond that. And the psalmist says, here, this is worth praising because I will not be put to shame. Can you define shame for me? When you hear that, what do you think of?
When I think of shame, I think of a feeling of, I don't know, self-disgust, a feeling of perhaps being, you know, and that's a more private thing, but maybe shame in front of people. So like your public image has been damaged in some sense. So those are the two things that come to mind when I think of shame.
Okay. So here's, in my own life, what made that really true is the idea that all of us have an inferiority complex.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't C.S. Lewis. And the reason why we try to beef up our own self-image is because we are constantly feeling inferior. And because of that explains all of our lies, all of our attempts to be, you know, to make believe that by dropping names we're more important than we are. And so I like the idea that the good news is that we are no longer needing to suffer this inferiority complex. We are loved with an everlasting love, and if that is true, then our inferiority is it's true, but it's temporary. And so the psalmist says, "Your righteousness delivers me." This is so beautiful. And if you have an inferiority complex, what we do is to say, "I'm really better than I am." The psalmist says, "No." Once you recognize it, say that God is better than you are, and he yeah. intends to donate his righteousness, which is, you know, something which we will have, and it frees us from the hand of the wicked, from the grasp of the unjust and cruel man. These are people who have an inferiority complex, who want to show their power by having power over others, and we're free from that. That righteousness, God donating his righteousness, is not a dry as dust idea, a definition of salvation. It is the one thing people with inferiority, people with a sense of shame, let's put it that way, need.
I feel like that's so significant, especially considering the incarnation, right? That Christ ascends to our level, not just to meet us there, but to raise us up.
Yeah,
to raise us up to that divinity, and so this psalm, you know, clicks a lot better with me now, knowing that it's not even, you know, we don't turn to ourselves even when we find ourselves in that shame, because there's nothing we can do. You know, God has come to do that, you know, to raise us up in that sense. So we look to him, right, who is, you know, who's known us from our mother's womb, even.
Yeah, that's the beautiful part, that we, well, a lot of it's beautiful, but that the shame is never can eclipse the beauty of that we have life. And what I like is the psalm then defines the shame. Our shame is that we're mortal, which is really weird. That mortal means death, right?
Right.
But at the moment that we become aware of our mortality, it shocks us. It's what one writer called an existential slap, which is really funny, because there's nothing more certain than that mortals suffer mortality. It's in our DNA, but that is our inferiority. And here's where it says, in old age, when my strength is spent, You know, when it seems that God has forsaken me, there's none to deliver me. Man, that just beautifully articulates the shame, right? Mm-hmm. And that doesn't matter, right? All those things is what we experience, but it isn't the truth of who we actually are if we are loved by God.
What's the enemy's role in this?
Well, that's right. I mean, it's what you had said last week, is that we need the enemy, actually. Right. Mm-hmm. We commonly we say, yes, we need the enemy because we are not truly practicing the love of God unless we're loving our enemies. Right. So the enemy is important there. But the enemy is, as we see all through the scriptures, Jesus uses the confrontation of the enemy in order to reveal more and more of the why the good news is really good. Right. Mm-hmm. So we shouldn't. I mean, it's a hard thing, but the enemy is hard to live with, but the enemy is also the person who believes in error, that and that belief in the error is, as we said last week, the very thing that drives us closer to the truth and draws the enemy into the truth. So, the enemy is a real character in the Psalms. You don't eclipse it like, let's all get along with one another. There's none of that kind of nonsense.
Always conflict.
Yeah, always conflict. And yet, the final word goes to praise. That in the end, all of these things work together, that if we saw reality for what it was, praise would be spontaneous and excessive. But for now, we don't see things. And maybe, you know, it'd be interesting to see how these scriptures tell us the enemy helps us see the truth by representing the lie and all that. So, good point. I didn't even pick that up at all, but I'm going to move on to Jeremiah because I think this is such a beautiful passage that the word is trustworthy to Jeremiah, God says, even though he is not experiencing it. And here is what God has to remind Jeremiah of, is that even though he seems to be, that his prophecies seem to be have no impact, God is making it quite clear that he is present. He has been present in Jeremiah's life from the time he was in the womb, that God is present always as our creator. But what Jeremiah is wondering is, at what point are you going to be our savior? Right? Well, I like that you got things going, but as you know, when you read the scriptures, God is also present as creator, and then later on, God is present as sustainer. So, but in this passage, we're not to overlook that there would be no fear of losing life if life hadn't first been given. Right? That's the first thing, is that the enemy can't destroy life unless there was a good life that had been given long before there was any evil in the world. And that is something that we confess in the Creed with the first article. Say, yes, I'm afraid of life slipping away, but then life was given to me without my consent. I didn't start it, and the God who started it is going to keep it going. But here's Jeremiah's problem. God intends to keep it going by us speaking. You know, he tells Jeremiah to speak, and he says, I do not know how to speak. You shall go, and whatever I command you, you shall speak. So in other words, you know, God understands the problem that we have been mentioning, that what we do just seems way beyond what we expect to happen. The preaching does not seem to have the power that is predicated to it, and yet, to Jeremiah, God says, no, of course you don't know how to speak, but you do it not because you are good at it. You do it because you are commanded to do it. And if you're commanded to do it, then you do it as well as you can. And then you just realize it's worth doing badly. That would be a good podcast name, I think.
That would be. Well, and I'm struck by this, you know, that you get echoes of the authority discussion again, because you know, God says to Jeremiah, I have put my words in your mouth, but with that, I have set you this day over nations and over kingdoms to block up and to break down. I mean, it's that kind of authority isn't the kind of authority you expect the prophet or the preacher to have.
No.
And yet
it sounds ridiculous.
It does. and yet that's what's been entrusted to us.
Well, and not the least of which is Jeremiah didn't know how to speak, but we still read his stuff. right? We
right.
still read the report about him. So the very act that we're reading this Old Testament passage and expecting it to give life is a verification of the promise that God had made to Jeremiah. You don't know the effect this is going to have, but it will continue to have bearing. So now Paul, and I know this is, you know, Lectio Continua, that there wasn't a lot of thought given to the epistle, you know, matching the gospel lesson. And so you really have to work hard here. But the fact that Paul begins by saying, I will show you a more excellent way. And I think Paul is playing on Jesus calling himself the way. And that this is what he is articulating in love. It's not what we can achieve. That the love that Paul is articulating step by step is the love that God manifested in Jesus. And as I said, if we are actually loved with the kind of love which is patient and kind and long-suffering, if that is actually the love that we're loved with, our inferiority complex is, you will still experience it, but it's unreal. Or it's at least slated to be rendered unreal, right? And what I like about this passage is that Paul refuses to allow anyone to treat this beautiful, kind of almost poetic depiction of love as a performance. You know, the idea that if I do the performance but not have the content, that's not the love that we're talking. We're talking about a love that where these words invite us into a deep participation.
That's what's sticking out to me, is that, you know, like you said, it's not just these actions. It's that there is a word paired with that, that, you know, that when I'm stuck on the verse, when I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. So all of those things come together, you know, the speaking and the thinking and the reasoning and the being, it all comes together to form a complete whole, so that, you know, we can't just reduce, you know, this love in action to just doing nice things.
Yeah, and that's what the bomb that goes off at the end. Love never ends. This is why the enemy is not to be feared. This is why physical difficulties are not to bring us down. It's because, again, cliche sounds like, but we are loved with this love. And that, whatever else ends in life, that does not end. And I think there's a kind of play on words here, that love is our end. It's our telos. It's the thing that completes us, but that love never terminates. So you have the idea that our end is not death. Our end is that we are beloved. And the whole point of this life is that God revealing to us as individuals. So we can never compare ourselves to others, because God will reveal it to each individual that we are beloved. And when we recognize that we're beloved, we recognize that life is filled with dying, and we die and we die. And then when we die, actually the dying stops and the life begins. That's what it means. And if we could believe that, it would make the experience of life so much better. And so the passage ends on, so now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. And I wonder, you know, being raised a Lutheran, and I am a Lutheran, where we talk about faith alone, and that love never gets mentioned at the heart and center of it. I think this would be an interesting question that will leave our vast audience, all three of them, to think about for next week.